As has become a tradition on Today or Love Tomorrow, the World Series, as soon as we finished recording, the Mets announced that Julio Teheran had elected free agency after being outrighted to AAA. So we talk about what he's going to do. Now we know. Enjoy the show. Hey, Mets fans, welcome back to Today Your Love, Tomorrow the World Series. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. And Chris, we are always recording in interesting times, but right now we are waiting at the final minutes of a rain delay for the Thursday afternoon getaway game against the Braves. Last night's game was rained out, and we recorded a week ago, but a lot has happened since we recorded. The Mets have won three games since we recorded and lost two. Both of those games they lost were not as pathetic as some of the losses that came early in the season, especially this week, the game against the Braves they lost on Tuesday night. The Mets came very, very close to coming back and winning that game. So the team does seem to have some more spunk to it. So, you know, it's time for our weekly vibe check. How do you feel about the Mets right now?
Much better than the last time that question was asked. I'd say just the fact they've won not only more than one game, but more games than they've lost from the time that we recorded last week till this week. That's pretty encouraging. The Reds maybe aren't a powerhouse team, but have enough going on that they're an interesting team. They're not the Marlins, who have started the season, I think 1-11 it is now. whatever their joke record is, they're not the A's. They're not the Nationals. Should be very bad and probably are playing a little bit above their real talent level in the very early going here. So, point being, the Reds aren't one of those teams, and the Mets won a series. They were in both games with the Braves. I still don't fully know how they escaped the first one with a win.
Same, yes.
But they did. I mean, there were multiple times in the ninth inning alone that I thought a ball was hit so hard that there was just no way that it was going to work out in the Mets' favor, but turned out it did. So, yeah, 3-2 in their last five against one top-tier team in all of baseball, and one other team that might be good enough to be in the wild card mix. And
I mean, that division is really so weird. Like, who knows? But, you know, yeah.
Well, yeah, that too. Right. They could win the damn division. You're right. But that sort of performance, seeing them win games where you might otherwise expect them to lose, like the first game of the series in Atlanta, seeing them win when they're not firing on all cylinders yet, offensively, in the Braves series so far, I can't really complain about the offense too much.
Right.
The Braves just happen to average 7 runs a game, but
yes,
back-to-back games of good offensive performance, and now if you look back at the last 5, the majority of those games, They've scored a number of runs. The pitching overall has looked pretty good. So, yeah, maybe getting a little closer to that team that we thought we might be seeing when we got all optimistic at the end of spring training.
Yes. Yes. Although I will say, you know, we have not seen the pitching be as consistent as we had hoped for. And I don't just mean in terms of performances. I also mean in terms of who's been pitching for the Mets. So a couple of news items here that are worthy of discussion. The first is that Kodai Senga was moved to the 60-day IL, which means May 23rd, is it now, I believe? His first day of eligibility back. Is that correct, Chris?
I think May 27th.
27th, I'm but sorry.
Same idea. Yeah. I doubt it'll be that exact day now.
Exactly.
Anyway.
Yeah. But so late May. And I think that's maybe a little bit later than we had hoped, but probably about the time we expected Senga to be back. But, you know, until then, the Mets made a signing last week, which we talked about, the Julio Teheran signing. And that era is seemingly already over. He made his one start for the Mets on Monday evening and looked very good for two innings and then not good for the, I believe it was two-thirds of an inning he lasted before being pulled from that game. The next day, he was designated for assignment. And, I guess there's a chance that he clears waivers, sticks around in the minors for a couple of weeks and comes back. That seems very unlikely to me. The Mets will have paid him. If he is not claimed and is just cut, I believe they will pay him $54,000 of his $1 million contract, if not mistaken. Oh, no, was it $1 million or was it $2.5 million? I'm getting my weird contracts they signed late in the
office. Yeah.
Confused here.
It's $2.5 million at the major league level, prorated to however many days.
Right. Yeah.
He's at that level. So
at 54,000 right now. Yeah.
Right. I didn't fully realize the details of that contract when they DFA'd him so quickly, but once a couple of the beat reporters sort of clarified that, it went from going, oh, that was a $2.5 million, 2 2/3 inning start to, oh, it was, I don't know. Yeah. Like you said, 50 grand, mm-hmm. probably.
Yeah.
Maybe even less. Because he was really only on the roster for what, 3 days?
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And look, I don't think anybody was watching that start beyond the first pitch of the third inning and thinking this guy is the solution for us for a little while. But were you a little surprised at the speed in which he was DFA'd?
Yeah, I'd say so. One, not super common, and look, we know the team's being run by a new person, but not super common in Mets history to bring in sort of a retread veteran and cut bait quickly. I think we've seen our fair share of extended looks at players who clearly don't have it in their first season with the Mets late in their own careers. Adrian Gonzalez having been a Met comes to mind.
Sure. Right? Jose Valverde.
Yep. Yeah. Jose Bautista.
Yes.
Yeah. And so on and so forth. I'm much more likely to remember a player fondly and just defend a player's ability to bounce back if he's already been on the Mets for a few years and been good for the Mets and now is at the ripe old age of 30 something. And
right.
And everything. Starling Marte this year. I won't go too far out on this tangent, but hey, he looks like a baseball player again.
He does.
So that's nice. But yeah, a little surprised how quickly they did that with Tehran. Maybe they saw that, look, nobody's going to claim him. Maybe they have, as has been suggested, online, that there might be some sort of pre-arrangement that if he clears waivers, that he'd be willing to go pitch in Syracuse. So, yeah, we'll see. The first two innings, I was willing to fool myself into, hey, this looks pretty good. And then it was just laser beam batting practice.
Yeah. I mean, look, in the guy's defense, he was in spring training with the Orioles, but then had a fair amount of layoff before he came to the Mets. And while he was, I'm sure, ready to pitch, he probably could have. It would have been nice to have him get a couple of more minor league starts in him, but the time was of the essence. They couldn't do that. So is he necessarily as bad as that third inning looked on Monday night? I don't know, but I can say it with almost definitive certainty that he's not as good as the first two innings looked either.
Yeah, that's fair.
I would have liked to see them maybe give him one more start, if only because the reasons I just said, give him a little more time. But also, and we're going to talk about this, I guess now is as good a time as ever to talk about it, just the aggressiveness in which the David Stearns run Mets are turning over players that are not necessarily being effective at the moment. You know, we saw Michael Tonkin DFA'd last week, right after we finished recording.
Yeah.
And, we saw Johan Ramirez DFA'd, and now Tehran DFA'd. We've seen players called up for one appearance and then sent back down to the minors. You know, those things obviously have happened before in Mets history, but it seems like there is very little patience for having an ineffective piece of the roster. And I appreciate that from a standpoint of the Mets can afford to go out and keep bringing in these, you know, very minor pieces. There is not the budgetary restrictions that were once there on the Mets, or they're on a team like the A's, for instance, which, you know, I'm sure if the A's could, you know, revamp their bullpen, they would love to do that, but they may not have the money to do so. The Mets have the money to do so. And so there's going to be these little moves made. And I don't really have a strong opinion about it. I mean, Tehran is the most surprising one because of the name attached with it and the relative lack of chance he got in the majors in 2024. But do you have any sort of strong gut feelings about the speed and efficiency with which this churn is happening?
I think it's probably a good thing. I don't know. A lot of those fringe relievers that we spent a lot of time thinking about late in spring training in terms of who was going to make the roster are probably all going to be gone by May 15th. On the bullpen side of things, they've called up a few relievers in the last few days who are obviously either going to get sent back down immediately, which has happened a couple times. They have churned the roster in a way that they've DFA'd a couple of people and at least replaced them with players who have options. But, there's still 40-man roster constraints to deal with. But we'll see how that goes. Some of the guys who have options might still get DFA'd. But in the case of the starting rotation, I'm glad that they acted faster than expected, because I think Buddo has just shown you something in his one start so far this year, late in the season last year, where, if fringe wild card or maybe first or second wild card spots are something that the team has in mind as a potential realistic goal this year, every game could matter. And I know if I had to pick a starter to pitch a game this weekend, and the Mets got a little bit of flexibility because of the rain out of Atlanta, but if I had to pick one just between Tehran and Buddo, I would take Buddo for sure. So in that sense, I like it. I like that it shows maybe having confidence in somebody who's younger and less proven in the course of his career, but looks considerably better right now. And it's funny because the overarching theme of my baseball fandom in my 20s and 30s has been having patience, zooming out, considering the whole picture and not overreacting to things that happen in a short span of time. But with the fragility of pitchers and the even what we see on the public side, and we know there's much more available internally to these teams, but the insane amount of data that there is about how a pitcher is pitching, whether it's, older advanced metrics, newer stuff of the StatCast era with spin rate and movement and everything like that, to analyzing their just sort of their biomechanics or whatever, right? There's all this stuff that is just there, that it might be easier for a team to say this guy is the better option right now. Mm-hmm. And let's take advantage of that while he's healthy, because the one thing none of us know it is when a pitcher is going to get hurt or if a pitcher is going to get hurt. So I like it. I was not really fond of adding Julio Tehran to the mix. then yeah, hopefully it works out with Budo. And if it doesn't, he's got options. Maybe Lucchese gets a shot, or Christian Scott is striking out the world in AAA in his first two starts. Maybe we're not that far off from seeing him get his shot in the big leagues.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think the one bit of sort of kismet here is that the Mets won that terrible start by Tehran, and maybe they just felt like we can't take that risk again. You know, we got out lucky once. Let's not push our luck here. But yeah, the other piece of news that we've got this week that I think is worth discussing is that JD Martinez is banged up, and there's not a date set for him to join the major league roster. Now, I knew we all expected there to be some sort of a lag in terms of the space between his signing and his appearance, because he had not been in spring training. They wanted to give him some minor league reps, but this is a little concerning. It's not terribly concerning, but you know, he needed an injection, and he is, I believe, being sat for 5 days. I believe we're in day three of that sitting right now. But so we're looking at, I think, best case scenario, maybe next week for Martinez to join the Mets. And you can't help but wonder in this circumstance, if the Mets had signed him a week earlier and he was able to get a week of Grapefruit League games in him, if this kind of thing could have been avoided. We'll never know. It's a little bit silly to argue that point, but it does make you wonder. So I guess my question for you, Chris, is does this at all concern you that we're seeing so much downtime between the signing and the debut for Martinez?
Yeah, it's definitely a little bit concerning. On the contract side of things, again, it's just the recurring theme that it's Steve Cohen's money and he can afford it if it is a situation that doesn't work out. Yeah. But his signing was definitely an exclamation point at the end of spring training for us. And I think for some of the guys on the team too, I think their reactions were pretty genuine when we heard whether it was Alonso, Lindor, Nimmo, those three sort of being the biggest identities on the team on the position player side, and hearing how they reacted to that news and getting that sort of, pun intended now, injection into their lineup. it's definitely a little bit concerning if he is in minor league games this weekend's probably a little too soon, but let's just say by next weekend, if he's gotten some reps at DH, whether it's in St. Lucie or Brooklyn or Syracuse or Binghamton, wherever, I think we can just say, all right, whatever. It just sort of the par for the course for a player who's his age and has, I think, a little bit of history with this, right? I don't specifically recall what injuries he dealt with when he was with other teams, but I know he's played in over 100 games per year, but not close to 162 in either of the last two seasons. But that's okay. I'm a little bit concerned, but not alarmed yet, if that works.
I think that's a very rational, reasoned discussion of this conversation. I guess my biggest concern is just, are the Mets avoiding? Let me back up for 1 second. The Mets have been so adept at turning over the bullpen piece of their roster, and it has felt to me like maybe they are waiting before trying to turn over anything with the lineup, with the bench, until Martinez is here to sort of make to have a better sense of what they really have before seeing what they need. I'm not saying the team should be making major moves right now, but like, you know, DJ Stewart hit a home run the other night, which was the first time his bat has shown any life basically this entire season. And yeah, I'm just hoping that the Mets are not holding off on doing a similar thing to their bench that they're doing for their bullpen, because they're waiting around for a guy who now we don't know when he's going to be showing up for the team.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, we'll hope for the best. And I think adding Martinez to this lineup, especially if this lineup starts to look a little bit more capable.
Yes.
Would be pretty exciting. But yeah, if DJ Stewart could just please pick it up between now and then, or if Vientos keeps doing what he's doing in AAA, I'm still skeptical on him as a major league hitter, but you know, that there is a point where he might be earning it, and yeah, we'll see. I hope it's a moot point. I hope by next weekend Martinez is not even just in minor league games, but ready to come and hit for the Mets.
Right. Right. Yeah, I suppose we'll know that sooner than later. So hopefully that decision is imminent and we don't have to think or worry about this too much longer. Aside from the Tehran signing, how are you feeling about the starting pitching at the moment? You know, we got one very good game from Sean Manaea and one okay game from Sean Manaea. We got a couple of Luis Severino starts that, you know, we're not terrible, but we're not fantastic. I'm not going to say your nickname for Jody Houser. Jody Houser is a comic book writer, I know. Adrian Houser, last night that you sent me.
The other night,
yeah. I won't necessarily reveal that one. But, like, you know, just overall, how do you feel about the starting pitching? Which I think, you know, that was my bold prediction to start the season, that this is actually going to be a strength for the team. How are you feeling about the starters so far?
Yeah, pretty good. I think higher on Severino actually at the moment than not only than I expected, but than maybe on how you feel about him at the moment. But I'm looking at, you know, stats to back my opinions up a little bit here as we do, but. Yeah, Manaea and Severino, I think both have looked great. Obviously, Severino's ERA was helped significantly by
a scoring decision.
The scoring change, right. But it was a justifiable change in scoring.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I've tried to graduate to using the percentage rates for walks and strikeouts, but per nine is still just such an easy one to look at real quick and say, is it good or bad? And in both cases, the strikeouts are there, more than 11 strikeouts per nine for each of those two guys. That's in both cases, I don't know if that's sustainable, but who doesn't love a starting pitcher who strikes out hitters? So those two have looked good and felt pretty good, I think, overall. Buto definitely had a nice spot start, and the expectation among everyone is that he will be back in the rotation soon, whichever day the Mets decide to use a fifth starter coming off the rainout. And then Quintana's looked okay. Hopefully he looks better today against the Braves. And Houser looked pretty good to the point that I was arguing to keep him in his first start longer and then his second start. And it's the one thing I could say in defense of Tehran is that he was not the only pitcher who looked like he was throwing batting practice this week. Houser was giving up hard contact to the Braves, and so did a couple of relievers. So, yeah, again, I'm totally fine with the decision, but it's one of those things that you got to remember that this is a team that just does this to pitchers. They are the offensive powerhouse in baseball. Somehow with, I'd argue, a more complete lineup than the Dodgers, who have Betts, Freeman, and Ohtani in the same damn lineup. But yeah, overall feeling pretty good, and it's way too early to do this sort of thing, but every mid-April is the same way. Like, what else are you going to do? You can't compare stats that haven't happened yet or from players who were on different teams or anything like that. But the Mets rotation right now is seventh in baseball in ERA. It's not the end all be all on April 11th, but it's, I'd rather, similar to what you said in spring training with those stats, I'd rather it be this than the opposite. I'd rather not say, oh, they're the seventh worst team in baseball when it comes to starting pitching. So,
yeah, even if these stats don't mean a lot, at least they're not miserable, right? Like, it's the, right. There's some hope to be had here. I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, you look, every other team in the top 10, most of them are teams that you would expect to be competitive. So, yeah, we'll see how it goes. We'll see where this all stands at the end of April or the end of May. Obviously, Memorial Day weekend gets referenced a lot as sort of a point when you can really start to take the temperature of what a team might be. But I've seen enough from the rotation to have it be a cause for optimism and not dread. So,
right.
That's good.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm right there with you for the most part. You know, I think that both Hauser and Severino are going to be wild cards. They're going to somewhat drive me crazy watching them pitch, just the way that those guys pitch. But Minaya has been a real pleasant surprise thus far. I think Quintana has been about what you expect him to be. Buto in his one start looked great. So, you know, this is the rotation right now until we get Senga back. And when we get Senga back, that will be around Memorial Day weekend. And so we'll have a better sense of what is needed here. You know, if the Mets all of a sudden have the five pitchers that are going to be in the rotation seemingly going forward now, if we're counting Buto in there, if all five are going well, maybe they make the decision to stick with a six-man rotation for a little while and ease Senga back in. Maybe one of these pitchers is shitting the bed on a regular basis and they feel they have to get them out of there as soon as possible. You know, there are lots of things that can be done around that time. And once we get close to the trade deadline, I hate to be a team that just plans for the trade deadline, because those, to me, those teams never really succeed. But if the Mets are in it, or if the Mets are in it around the trade deadline, they have a stocked farm system now that you could probably say goodbye to one of those players and return a decent starting pitcher at the deadline. So, you know, we'll see what happens here. It's encouraging that we're not in doom and gloom mode already with the starting rotation and with the bullpen. You know, with the exception of those two Tonkin appearances, which both, you know, you and I have talked about this on the podcast before, and I wrote about it a couple of times too. You know, Tonkin is a multi-inning guy, not a big strikeout guy. He's the worst possible option to bring in the 10th inning or the 11th inning, when the game is tied and there's a man on second base. He's the guy I would least likely have brought in from the bullpen in those situations. So you can't even really totally blame Tonka. I mean, he still pitched like dog shit, don't get me wrong, but you know, he wasn't put in a position to succeed necessarily. And so what we're looking at here is we're looking at a pitching staff that, like you said, is number seven in baseball right now, that is working out. The biggest problems with the team thus far have been offensive, and it seems like this Braves series, you know, the Mets already are up 1-0 at the end of the first inning. You know, the Mets are, the bats are coming alive a little bit, and so I'm fairly, maybe optimistic's too strong of a word. I'm okay with where everything sits right now, going into the third week of the season, and hoping that some of those moments that were so frustrating, whether it was the, you know, having Beatty bunt with no one out the other day, last week, or the aforementioned Tonkin things, like, hopefully those are a manager's first week, first 10-day jitters, and Mendoza can settle down a little bit, because with the Nationals as bad as they are, and with the Marlins starting off the year as atrociously as they are, the Mets have a chance to make up, you know, to start to develop themselves as a middle of the pack or upper National League East team right now. And you said last week, seasons aren't won in April, but seasons can be lost in April, it seems like. And as long as the Mets can keep doing what they're doing, keep steady and just generally hold the fort until Senga's back, until Martinez debuts, I feel fairly good about this team.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, it's definitely a place that's not where I expected to be after they started 0-5.
Yes. Agreed. How much difference a week can make in terms of how you feel, for sure. Well, Chris, unless you have anything else that's burning a hole in your podcast pocket, let's get to our music recommendations of the week. What do you want to talk about?
Sure. So last night I had the pleasure of seeing Alejandro Escovedo live for the first time. And I will admit I need to do a little more homework before I land on an album rec. I really enjoyed the show, but I'll get there. And at some point, a little spoiler alert or sneak preview, there will be a rec at some point from his vast work as a musician. But the album rec is still inspired by that show. The pre-show mix that was on, typically the artist's choice, and you can usually tell when it's definitely the artist's choice. There was just a whole lot of Soundgarden playing, before the show and between the opener and when Escovedo went on himself. So I feel like it's only appropriate to go ahead and recommend a Soundgarden record. It hasn't happened in the history of this podcast. I think a lot of bands that are that big and were around and, you know, their heyday was when we were children / teenagers. I think it'd be easy to kind of take that stuff for granted, but I'm going with Bad Motorfinger. You could really make an argument for several Soundgarden records if you wanted to reach back and make one of them an album pick these days. But I think the late Chris Cornell sounds as good as ever on this record. And it just starts with loud, energetic, heavy rock. And Soundgarden, I think, could be a little bit darker at times, but never lacked energy. But,
oh, no.
Rusty Cage that starts this record off, not only would it be good without these other things linked to it, but I know as things were finally starting to actually get a little bit better coming out of the worst of COVID, a friend of mine had looked for songs that people were sort of going to in that moment of like, hey, things are getting better. So Rusty Cage to me is a good, it was a good song for that. You know, I'm going to break my Rusty Cage and run, right? Like that's self-explanatory. But even before it felt like a song for coming out of COVID, it's a good one for when the weather's starting to get warm. Personally, now with some winter travel to winter places, I'm like, no, send me back to the Arctic. I don't want summer anymore. But on a baseball podcast, I guess I should say that, you know, when it's starting to get warm out, like we've gotten some, some of so far this spring, it's a great song for that too. And I've spent this much time talking about the first track.
And you didn't even mention Johnny Cash's cover of it.
Well, I was going to, and then I felt like I spent too much time on one song, but yeah, Johnny Cash's cover is awesome. So it inspired that. I promise you, this is not going to be a track by track breakdown of the whole record, but the second track, Outshined, also a great song. Has one of my favorite lines in the history of music. Look in California, film in Minnesota.
Yeah, yeah. That maybe is the definitive Soundgarden song. I know people would probably say Black Hole Sun, but to me, Black Hole Sun doesn't really sound like Soundgarden as much as Outshine sounds like Soundgarden.
Yeah, yeah. More representative. I'd agree.
Yeah.
And this record, just start to finish, to me, there's really not... there's not a bad moment on it. Searching with My Good Eye Closed might even be like that. That could even be the best song on the record, depending on, you know, what your mood is for ranking their songs that day. But yeah, it's a damn good album. I don't think anybody will have forgotten it, but we are at the point that I think we might have drawn in some listeners who maybe weren't around when Soundgarden was around.
Sadly, it was
A really active band.
Yeah.
So if any listeners are, I don't know, Corey from Amazing Avenue, his age.
Yeah.
Maybe your exploration of past music didn't quite get to Soundgarden yet, and I hope this helps. And even if everybody who is hearing this knows this record well, I hope it's a reason to throw it on when you're out and about in, on a nice spring day.
Yeah, that's a great recommendation. Soundgarden is a band I never got to see live, and it's a huge bummer. All right, for mine, and you're all going to be very thankful I'm not doing a song-by-song breakdown of this, because the length of this record is right in its title, and that is the Magnetic Field's 69 love songs. So if I was doing a track-by-track breakdown, we'd be here all day. But last night, I was at the first of two shows at Town Hall at the Magnetic Fields are doing. They're doing the complete 69 love songs, the full three-disc record in order. So last night, I believe it was 34 songs they did, and they will finish up with the following 35 tonight. For those who don't know the Magnetic Fields, Stephen Merritt is the songwriter and the sort of mastermind behind it, the only permanent member, really, kind of, sort of. But a super literate writer, a super classic writer. Like, he's somebody who absolutely abhors the near rhyme. All of his lyrics rhyme perfectly. No, you know, close enough for kind of, you know, for rock and roll. No, all of his lyrics are perfectly rhymed. He's a very classic songwriter in the style of like a Rodgers and Hammerstein or a Irving Berlin, you know, just the sort of very, very articulate, very clever lyrics. And 69 love songs is exactly what it sounds like. It is 69 tracks about love. Now, that doesn't mean they're all sort of flowery love songs in the way you might expect them to be. Some of them are angry. Some of them are funny. Some of them are sort of jokes. Some of them are really sad. It's a really interesting collection. And the instrumentation on stage to replicate this, there's a full-time ukulele player, a full-time acoustic guitarist, a full-time cello player, and then two keyboard players, one who plays about half the time and one who plays a lot more but also is responsible for all the drum machines, because there's no live drums in the record. It's all drum machines. So there's some pre-programmed drums. And then a guy playing guitar, banjo, electric guitar, banjo, and acoustic guitar over the course of the show. And so it's almost like a chamber pop instrumentation. And there's five singers singing songs on stage. So you're getting a lot of different types of music represented across there. You know, there are songs that sound like Broadway musicals. There are songs that sound like, you know, sort of 60s AM pop. There's a song called Punk Love that just sounds like a loud punk rock song. There's a song called Love Is Like Jazz. It sounds like a bullshit experimental jazz song. Like, there's just a lot of interesting music happening. And it's a show that really feels like a show seeing it live, because just the songs don't really connect in the way that a lot of records do, where there's sort of a thematic musical element throughout. The thematic element is that they're all love songs, but they're all such different love songs. And I firmly believe that if you are an adventurous musical sort, there is at least probably one album's worth of songs that you will come out of this really enjoying if you give it a shot. You may not like certain voices or certain styles, but there's enough variety there that you could find something for yourself, I would think. And I'm just going to give three quick song recommendations, one from each disc of the album, because it is a lot to sort of take in all at once. And so starting in disc one, the third track, All My Little Words, a beautiful song about a breakup and wanting the person to come back. I'm from disc two. Let's see what we got here. Papa Was a Rodeo, which is like a Western song. That is a great, great lyric in that song. Oh my goodness. Such a fun song. And then from disc three, we'll go with How to Say Goodbye. Just another, again, gorgeous, gorgeous song. And yeah, so a really interesting experiment in music. if you have, I guess it's over 3 hours, probably the 2 hours and 45 minutes. Look at that. A very conservative amount of time, 2 hours and 45 minutes to dig into this. I would highly recommend it, but just poke around, look at the song titles. It sound interesting. Some of the songs are quite short. Just have some fun with it. It's good. There's everything you could possibly want and stuff you definitely don't want on this album too. So that is my recommendation. 69 Love Songs by the Magnetic Fields. Two very different albums. Playing Outshined and then Reno, Dakota from this album would probably melt your brain. So that's okay though. It's good to have different things in your life now and then. So anyway, thank you all for listening. We can I almost said Amazing Avenue Podcast. We are not Amazing Avenue Podcast. We are Home Run Applesauce Podcast. You can find a Home Run Applesauce Podcast just about every day of the week right now. We are going to be adding another show soon, I think, maybe kind of, sort of, or at least adding some new things. Go to our Patreon. We've already done a couple of bonus episodes this season so far over to our Patreon, patreon.com/homerunapplesauce. Chris is on Instagram @ChrisMcShane. I am on Instagram @BrianIntoNap. And until next time, especially against the Braves, let's go Mets.